you're doing is allowing all these other people that we spend all of our time at the NCAA saying, you can't recruit through a third party. You can't be involved with third party people. And that's exactly what you're doing, creating all these third parties that's going to get involved with the prospects and all that. And then who gets exposed on that? I go to a camp, and I'm talking to some guy, I don't know, from Adam's house cat, and he's representing some kid because he put the camp on, and then I'm in trouble for talking to this guy? I'm just saying it's bad for college football. Jim Harbaugh can do whatever he wants to do. I'm not saying anything bad about him if he thinks that's what's best. There needs to be somebody that looks out for what's best for the game, not what's best for the Big Ten or not what's best for the SEC or not what's best for Jim Harbaugh, but what's best for the game of college football.
Well, Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh fired back at Saban's comments with this tweet. Amazing to me. Alabama broke NCAA rules, and now their head coach is lecturing us on the possibility of rules being broken at camps. Truly amazing.
Not my concern. I don't get involved in all that underdog, overdog, whatever the case may be. It's stupidity. One thing for me is just how well I can get my team prepared mentally and physically to go out for battle. It's going to be a tough test for us, and we know that. We're better built to start the finals than we were last year. It doesn't matter who it's against.
The 1-1. Fly ball left field, way back and gone.
Are you kidding me?
An absolute no doubter to left. CJ Krohn's son of the game. He had three for the season coming in, and the Angels walk it off. Tigers had rallied from seven runs down to tie with home run power. The Angels win it on a walk-off by Krohn with another home run.
Can't make this up.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, yeah. Good Wednesday afternoon to you. Thank you for joining us for the extravaganza at 9 minutes past the hour of 3 o'clock. 2 hours of scintillating discussion and dialogue, and if need be, even some debate right here. As we bring you the best coverage, the best conversation, the best opinions, the best analysis in the business. In Northwest Ohio, quite frankly, I don't care. Northeast Ohio, Southwest Michigan, Cleveland, Detroit, South Bend, anywhere else for that matter. We like what we do, and we like when you're a part of it. So thanks for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader and much, much more. And in fact, Cushlin, we are going to be much, much more today because we're going to both cities that are going to be contending for the world championship in the sport of professional basketball. Coming up at 3:35, our very good friend and frequent guest from the Cavaliers side of things. He is beat writer, has been doing beat writing for the Cavaliers, covering the Cavaliers for his newspapers for about 15 years. Rick Nolan will talk to us. Then we're going out west to the San Francisco Bay. My former stomping grounds, as a matter of fact, and one of the guys I used to work with out there is Damon Bruce. He's still a talk show host out there on 95.7 The Game. He is all in on the Dubs, the way we are all in on the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA Finals, which start tomorrow night. So we will talk to Damon about the matchup coming up, and that'll be at 4:05 today. So we have a lot of basketball coverage to bring you today. We want you to be a part of it too, by the way. Don't just sit there and be a passive listener all day long. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you want to just sit and listen, it's okay. I would rather have you listen because I have lots to say. But if given the choice, I want you to talk and give us something to listen to as well. More voices, more ideas, more analysis from more people really, I think, brings out more enjoyment for all of these things to us. So with that in mind, we'll throw it to you at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. And we can also take your thoughts, if you don't want to wait on hold, by reading your comments to us when you tweet them to Sports Radio 1065, Sports Radio 1065. That's our Twitter handle. Save it and follow us there. And then on Facebook, you can comment to us at 1065 The Ticket, 1065 The Ticket, and leave your comments and any of the story posts that we have there for you on Facebook as well. So a lot of NBA to get into today. And it's funny, I was watching and reading and listening to, obviously, television, websites, and radio today on a lot of national scales, Jim Cushlin, including, of course, our own Mike and Mike and a little bit of Russillo and Cannell before us. A lot of people are picking up on what, and I'm not saying they're listening to me. Don't get me wrong. This isn't like some ego boost here. But what we were talking about yesterday about how, remember what I said? The subplot of this particular series, this finals, might actually be big enough to overtake the series itself, the championship, as the main plot. And that is the LeBron versus Steph, who's really the best player in the NBA argument. That's all I heard today. I heard it on ESPN Radio. I read it on a number of blogs and sports websites, and then I saw it on some ESPN television as well, for example, on First Take this morning. And they're all talking about the same thing that I brought up yesterday. And again, I'm not saying I invented this topic, but I'm kind of glad that we're not dovetailing off of them. They're dovetailing off of us, at least for our purposes. But they're talking about LeBron James' very public, I don't want to call it a pout festival because that would be very disrespectful. And I don't think he was pouting as much as he was just saying, look, y'all can say what you want to say about the MVP award, but remember, there's a difference between MVP and best player. He deserves the MVP. How can you doubt it? But, you know, he made it clear that there's a difference. And as a four-time MVP, he kind of would know a little bit about it, talking about LeBron James. But all these shows today, Jim, have been talking about here's his opportunity to prove it. Here's his opportunity to not just win a championship and stop himself personally from losing three straight NBA finals. Because if he does that, you know, we're approaching Jim Kelly territory. Four straight Super Bowl appearances and four straight losses. Now, the difference being, of course, LeBron did get two, but he's 2-4 right now. If they lose to the Warriors, it would be 2-5, and he would have a three straight finals losing streak that would put a dent in his legacy, according to what folks are saying. But now, more importantly, on the positive side, he has a chance to take the crown. Well, let me revisit that. He has a chance to retain the crown that he wears as King James and has worn as best player in the NBA for a long time, according to most observers, one of the greatest of all time. He has a chance to retain that crown against the guy that a lot of people say has already stolen it or is on the verge of doing it. If Steph Curry beats him head up, two straight finals in a row, completing seasons in which he was MVP, two straight regular seasons in a row, if he does that, and especially if he does it with Curry-esque fourth quarters, the way he did, well, pretty much throughout the playoffs this year, except for when he was injured. If Steph does that and takes it away from LeBron head-to-head, I don't think there's any saving the crown for the king. He's going to be the king with no crown. It's going to be worn by King Steph, two-time finals champion or NBA champion and two-time league MVP, et cetera, et cetera. But if LeBron can go out there with his full supporting cast of Kyrie Irving, Kevin Love, J.R. Smith, Channing Frye, Iman Shumpert, or Iman Shumpert, if you will, and Tristan Thompson, if he can go out there with the best team he's been surrounded by and actually punk sports-wise, of course, Steph Curry, and win not just against the Thunder, because that matters here. If the Thunder would have closed out that series, and this was LeBron against Durant and Westbrook and so on and so forth, if he wins, it's great. Don't get me wrong, it's great, but he wins the title against somebody that is not the defending champion and not the defending two-time MVP, Steph Curry. If Curry's sitting at home watching that thing on TV, it's not the same. The stars are aligned right now for LeBron James to go and take it away from the guy, or retain it, depending on your point of view, from the guy trying to take it from him. Man up, head up, my team against yours. You know, best man wins this championship. Best player wins this championship. And that's all that the nation is talking about today, at least in the sports world, in which you and I live most of the time, Jim. This is what they're saying, that this may be a bigger story than the finals itself. Perhaps not to the city of Oakland, California, or the greater Bay Area, because they themselves just won one last year, and not winning two in a row, it's not like the biggest heartbreak in the world. To the people of Cleveland, it might be always bigger because they haven't won a championship in that city since 1964. So the individual rivalry would not overtake the game / series / championship rivalry in that town. But for the rest of America that doesn't have a rooting interest in this, just watching the two best players in the NBA, or depending on your point of view, you know, two of the best players in the NBA, watching them go head up for the title. Who's the best player? Who really deserves MVPs? Who really is the, you know, the best all-around player, etc.? That subplot could very well become the main plot by the time they toss it up for the first time tomorrow night, Kush.
No, it could be. And I'm kind of glad that in its own way, even though, again, it's not like we invented it. We'd like to claim that we did, but I don't think that's going to fly exactly. But bringing this whole conversation up, and I've been thinking about it for the last day, and there's one thing that I want to throw out there, because the grand talk is more LeBron right now than Steph's side of it, but it's that whole legacy thing. And you even said that word a couple times. And
that's what was all over TV today that
right,
I'm talking about. I mean, it's right out there, splashed across the screen. LeBron's legacy on the line? You know, Dennis D-Man, of course, was just angry about that. How dare anybody say that? But it's what people are asking right now. Is his legacy on the line? If he loses and falls to 2-5 in the finals, 0-2 against Curry, the guy trying to steal his title as the face of the NBA, the best player, then you know what? Maybe his legacy is on the line. Go ahead.
And I get that. And there is obviously the way it's brought up, and it's understandable because, to be honest with you, I've also been thinking about this for a day. My call right now, Bob, is Warriors in 7 because I think it has the potential, with the Cavs being fully healthy, to go that far. But I don't think anybody's winning a Game 7 there. And so I get that the conversation comes out in the context of LeBron and the Cavs losing. And I get that. And, you know, that is a nice, valid, legitimate debate to be having if he falls to 2-5 and so on and so forth. What's interesting is there's a complete absence of the win and going to 3-4. He's 2-4 right now. Mm-hmm. And what that would do, because it's not just he would improve his finals record to 3-4, and I have a list here of some of the other all-time greats that have been to at least like 3 or 4 beyond finals in their records. And we know the Jordan 6-0. Some of the others are actually more mixed than one might think on the surface.
Yeah, I read some of those to Dennis yesterday, just some
right,
of the all-timers that we know about. You know, Magic was, what, 5-4?
Magic's 5-4. You got Bird at 3-2. Sure, you have Jordan 6-0. Duncan's 5-1. Kobe's 5-2. The Logo's 1-8. Wilt's 2-4. Dr. J's 1-3. 3-3 if you count ABA, but I'm sure most wouldn't. So he's still in.
What was Kareem? Because Kareem won 6.
Oh, you know what? That's the one. I got to look him up again because I misplaced that one.
He had
one
to have been on a couple of those.
Well, he won. I think he split when he was in Milwaukee at the beginning of his career. And
what
then,
I mean is he was mad. Magic went to 9 finals, which is pretty amazing, by the way. And LeBron is on 8. So, I mean, it's a great pace for him. But Kareem was part of those. So if Magic was 5-4. Then Kareem had to have lost 4 also, because he was on all of those, right?
Right.
Plus the one in Milwaukee.
There were 2 in Milwaukee. I know for a fact he split.
No, but he won one and lost one.
Right, exactly. He split 1-1 in Milwaukee.
Right. So if he lost 4 with Magic and the Lakers and lost 1 in Milwaukee, that's 5 L's. That would be, so he's won 6-5.
That sounds about right. I'll double check the math here in a minute when I have a chance to look at the
Russell plan. Russell played in 11, and he only lost what, 2 of them maybe?
He was 11-1 actually.
11-1.
11-1. The only one they lost was that one that would have made it like 12. 13
sorry,
in
right,
a row. Yeah, he went to 12 total.
Gotcha.
So the point that I'm trying to make, and I'll get you the exact numbers on Kareem here in a second, is I just find it fascinating that the whole conversation is on that end, and I get that. I'm sitting here calling the Warriors right now in this series.
But it's not just that. You know, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I don't think it's just, hey, if he loses, he's 2-5, and then we get, you know, compared to all these other guys you're talking about. It's not just, that's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big part of it. But the other part of it is his personal stance about being the best player, his statement last year that he's the best player, even in the playoffs. I'm still the best player in the world. And then this year when the unanimous, which clearly bothered him, that the first guy to ever win a unanimous MVP is not him, it's Steph. And then saying, I'm still better, essentially, with his difference between best player and most valuable. So it's not just, hey, the 2-5. That is a big, big part of it. But now it's, you are saying that you're still better than this guy who has lit up the NBA for 402 or 3 three-pointers, led the league in scoring, led the league in steals, led the league in three-point percentage, led the league to 73 wins, for crying out loud, and all of that stuff. it's personal in that way too. It's not just do you win or lose the series to fall to 2-5 or rise to 3-4. It's also how will you play against that guy. He has become known, has Curry, for being a fourth quarter specialist. Well, I played the clip yesterday from some of the guys at ESPN who are calling him the greatest closer, the greatest fourth quarter closer since MJ. And if he closes on LeBron in the same way, it's going to be very hard for LeBron to keep going to cameras and saying, I'm the best player in the world. It's going to be very hard if he loses to Steph Curry for the second time in a row to say, I'm still the best player today, let alone where I sit all time, at which point this record you're talking about in the finals starts to come into play.
No, and I'm glad you said some of those things because, again, what I'm trying to say is, and I'm saying it's a legitimate debate to have. It really is.
Yeah, it
on
is.
The 2-5, especially on the 2-5. I just find it interesting that where would his 3-4 be amongst, and by the way, finish doing the math real quick. Kareem was 6-4 total. 1-1 in Milwaukee, 5-3 with the Lakers.
But Magic was 5-4 at the Lakers. So did he retire before Magic's made his last Magic
yes,
made his last
yes,
finals?
Yes, Magic's last trip to the finals,
that's
remember,
why,
was
okay.
against Jordan, and Kareem retired after 89 after the Bad Boys swept him. So, but you mentioned Curry and the MVP and the best player debate and the 73 wins and all that, you know, yeah, little bias here. Let's throw in the fact that, oh, my goodness, it would also be Cleveland actually won something. What would all that do if he's then 3-4? And I just find it interesting that that angle is not happening. It's just the 2-5 angle. I'm just throwing that out there.
You mean if it's 3-4?
If it's 3-4, with the fact that...
Because it's not a big deal. That's why. Because he's still under 500 in titles. He's still under 500 in championship runs. And all of the guys that you just said, I mean, first of all, let me say this. Does this not really give us perspective on how amazing Michael Jordan really was? When
Sure.
we talk about the greatest players, not only of that era, but of all eras, we say the names of Jordan and Magic and Bird and Abdul-Jabbar, and we say them almost, you know, together at all times. They're all among the top 5 to 8 to 10 players in NBA history, so we always lump them together, right?
Right.
Well, most of those guys are barely over 500 in titles. 5-4 for Magic, as you said, 6-4 for Kareem, 3-2 for Larry Bird. And so when you look at all of those greats, and I'm kind of discounting Russell to a small degree only because of what he where he played and how he played and when he played and the number of Hall of Famers he played with. I mean, it was the greatest franchise of all time that probably would have won a whole bunch of titles without Bill. And because he was there, you know, it was ridiculous 11-1. So I'm kind of discounting that a little bit. But among the other guys we're talking about in more of a modern time, most of those champions who are all-time champions are just a little over 500. And then here's Mike at 6-0. With 6 finals MVPs. And that don't think that that's just like a given. Of course it would be. I mean, Steph wasn't the MVP last year of the finals. It was Iguodala.
Exactly.
And
deservedly so, if you're going to not give it to LeBron.
Well,
I disagree.
Because they gave it to him, despite the fact that he wasn't scoring very much, they gave it to him because he played LeBron so well, and it's one of those things where we talked about it a year ago when this was going on, and I'll talk about it now a year later. You know, defensively, he held LeBron to 35, 12, and 7, or 12 and 8 a game. I mean, almost a triple-double, and LeBron was the only thing they had going because it was Delly as the next scoring threat, or Mozgov, because of the way things were. So I don't understand why Iguodala got it. I know, you know, he came up big in moments, I suppose, but it's a weird thing. My point is, voters don't just automatically give the MVP to the best player of the winning team. In that case, you know, it would be Steph Curry in a lot of other cases. But the MVP doesn't always go to the best player of the winning team. It's the voters have to vote. Well, in Jordan's case, he won all 6 of them in all 6 titles, and we all know that had he not decided he wanted to try hitting curveballs, it would have been 8 in 8 years, and I don't think anybody can possibly dispute that. especially given the fact that he came back from those 2 years away from the game in the same peak form he was before by winning three more in a row. So that's a lot of talking to say that LeBron's 3 and 4, and this is where you are going with the question, Jim, if they win this thing, isn't going to mean much because he's still below 500. And, of course, because his story is not yet finished. His book isn't yet completely written. There are many chapters still to come. So if he plays 5 more years, 6 more years, how many more finals does he get to? 5 or 6, possibly. And will he? But the thing is, he would have so much to overcome at 2 and 5. Just to get to the 500 or above mark, like 5 and 4 Magic Johnson in finals and 3 and 2 Larry Bird. He would have to, you know, end up playing in 12 or 13 finals like Russell did, just to maybe hope to get to 6 and 5. He's 2 and 5 if he loses this one, or to get to 7 and 6 or whatever it might be. If he wins this one 3 and 4, it's like, all right, there's a step. Do it again next year and have a repeat. And now you're 4 and 4. Now you're getting closer. So it's just, the 2 and 5 would look like such a glaring hole in the overall resume when compared to the other guys we talked about, and it will look like the Grand Canyon compared to 6-0 Mike. And I think that's why nobody's focusing on the 3 and 4. It would be a baby step to the good, but a 2 and 5, a loss, would be a massive, giant step backwards to the bad, I think is what most people are saying.
And that's fair, and that really is, because there is total truth to the 2 and 5 and all the other angles that then stem from that. I just wonder if also in the win scenario where he's 3 and 4, because I agree, you know, to really, really then cement the argument going forward in the remainder part of his career, he's got to get that finals record over 500. I completely agree with that in the overall, because again, looking at the giant, the little list of just guys that I threw out there, only Wilt and Jerry West were below 5, or Dr. J were below 500. Everybody else is pretty good. And then you get to the Jordans, Duncans, and Russells, of course, with 11-1 and what have you. You don't think that there's any kind of interesting NBA flashpoint overall in its history, because you'd have a guy who would have been on the team that defeated the record holder in terms of wins, that
it would count for more, that it would be a weighted championship?
In addition to the fact that the whole Cleveland thing, too.
That latter, I think, much more than the former. The latter much more than the former, because I don't think the New York Giants are super Super Bowl champions because they beat the team that had won more regular season games than anybody in history at undefeated at 16-0. I think they're just the Super Bowl champions.
Right.
And people say, yeah, and you know, they knocked off the undefeated Patriot. I don't think the Cavaliers would be a super NBA champion, on a different level because they beat a team with 73 wins. I do think LeBron's legacy will get extra bonus points, so to speak, because he did what he said he was going to do. He came back from Miami, where he won 2 and lost 2, and said, I'm going to try this again in my home city, and I won't get into all of the personal things I have about that whole situation. But he did say, I'm going to come back there and win a championship in Cleveland. That is his mission. That is his goal. If he did that, and he lifted, quote-unquote, Believe Land, from the depths of 50 years of misery, 1964, now 52 years, right?
Yep.
1964 being the last championship for any of the major sports franchises there, and actually did it. I think there would be bonus points in terms of historical representation for that, much more than just beating the team that had 73 wins. I just I think that would be a very, very minor footnote in the whole thing.
And I kind of agree with that concept. I mean, I'm not really trying to compare, but I guess I'm throwing it out as an example of what I mean by kind of an interesting, almost legendary flashpoint in NBA history. 1970 with Willis Reed. I mean, the whole mental aspect that emanated from that scene and he probably shouldn't have been playing. And remember, he only scored the first two baskets, and then he didn't play the rest of the game. So, you know, it's one of those kind of legendary flashpoint moments, too, is what
he
I'm trying to argue
one
if that happens.
I don't know if I like that particular comparison, because he can't just be symbolic. Willis was symbolic.
Yes.
That was symbolic. It just inspired his teammates. Oh, my God, he's coming out here on a torn-up knee, and he can barely run up and down the court, but he makes a couple of shots, and it just fires the whole building up. The whole thing is just legendary. LeBron needs to score 42 baskets. Oh, I'm sorry, 21 baskets, 42 points for this to get done, not just be symbolic. So,
Fair enough.
But the symbolism about lifting Cleveland, I think, is there if that's what happens. Beating the defending champion certainly is a point, too. The 73-win thing, I think, less so. And then there's the individual matchup. If he beats his nemesis now,
yeah.
And it's weird because they don't play the same position, but Steph Curry has become, according to many, the best player in the NBA. We talked about it at length throughout the season, and taking LeBron's crown is something LeBron does not suffer lightly. He is not happy about that suggestion. He has made it very clear. He even yesterday at practice, he takes umbrage to the notion that Vegas has the Warriors as prohibitive favorites, and he was asked, how do you feel about being an underdog against them again? And he dismissed it with kind of like, man, I don't care about underdogs or overdogs or whatever it is. The whole thing's stupid. It was bitterness. He did not sound happy that, once again, he is being counted out and Steph is being lauded as being the man and the Warriors as the men. And so if he can face all of those things down and win this thing, the move to 3-4 is a baby step. Beating the defending champions gets you a little bonus points, leading Cleveland to their first win since 64 as a city gets you some bonus points. But if you lose this one, all of those things take a giant step backwards. We're going to talk to Rick Noland about that coming up. We're going to go to the Bay Area at 4:05. Damon Bruce is a San Francisco sports talk show host. Good guy. I know him. I used to work with him a little bit when I was out in the Bay. He is all in on the Dubs. We're all in on the Cavs. So we'll get to that coming up at about 4:05. And you, whenever you're ready, at 866-240-1065 right here on The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
That is indeed what it is right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. We're focused on two cities this afternoon, and will be tomorrow afternoon and tomorrow evening. We have a few other things to get into, but we're focused on Cleveland and Oakland, or more specifically the greater San Francisco Bay Area. We're going to go to both cities coming up at 4:05. We're going to talk to Damon Bruce, a talk show host out there at 95.7 The Game, who is all in on his Dubs. And first, though, we're going to go to Cleveland, and we want to say good afternoon once again to our good friend who has been covering the Cleveland Cavaliers for his newspaper for, I don't know, a decade and a half or more. I don't know. How many years have you been on the beat there, Rick Noland?
30.
30?
I started with Mark Price, Brad Doherty, Ron Harper, Wayne Embry, and Lenny Wilkins.
Oh, man. Well, you know what? I'm going to tell you this, and I'm not saying this to flatter you. I don't need to flatter you. I've had you on the air many, many times, so you've come on without flattery before. But I wouldn't have guessed that only because you don't look like you are old enough to have been doing this for 30 years. And I mean, either that or you're using a really old profile pic for your byline.
Let's just say I started when I was 8. How about that?
All right. Well, hey, Rick, thanks again for joining us. Rick Noland has been with us for a lot of these playoffs, either giving us previews or analysis of games gone by. So I guess we're in preview mode right now. I've been watching a lot of national TV today and listening to a lot of national radio shows just to kind of put my finger on the pulse of what people are saying about these finals coming up here. And what I'm hearing, Rick, is a lot of what I actually talked about myself yesterday, and that is that there is a subplot here that is almost as big as the actual championship itself, that the battle between LeBron and Steph for, you know, fictional title, if you will, of best player in the NBA, it's so big and there's so much meat there that it almost threatens to upstage the entire thing for the teams. If one of those teams wasn't Cleveland looking for their first championship in 52 years. But that's what's on the line here. And LeBron has made it very, very clear that he doesn't like the idea that Steph is the MVP, that he's the unanimous MVP, and that the MVP means best player. He made a difference between those two things, or distinction between those two things. So there's a lot riding on this for LeBron personally in this battle with Steph, you know, as we all obviously watch the actual battle between the Cavs and the Warriors.
Yeah, you know, that's what happens, Bob, when you have a star-driven league. You know, the NBA promotes its superstars and loves to put them out front of the teams. Fortunately, though, this is going to be a fantastic series for that reason and the fact that, you know, we have what most people thought we were going to have all year, the Cavs and the Warriors. The LeBron-Steph subplot only adds to it. But, you know, you go back to last year, you know, Steph didn't have a tremendous series in the finals last year, and LeBron put up absolute monster numbers. In fact, I just saw the Game 5 interview with LeBron after the Cavs fell behind 3-2, and he said he wasn't worried, I'm the best player in the world. You know, he's refrained from that comment all year this season, although he has, you know, in his own passive-aggressive way, made it clear that he still feels that way.
I think he did even more than passive-aggressive, Rick, though, at the time that the unanimous MVP was announced. And that's when he made the point of saying, you know, of course Steph deserves MVP. It's fine. He shot 90, 50, 40, that whole commentary that he did there.
Right.
Said, but then there's valuable, and then there's, you know, most valuable, and you can try to figure out what the difference is there. But there's a difference. And I thought that was kind of the way of saying what he said a year ago. You can give him whatever award you want. I'm still the best player in this game.
Well, I don't know that I disagree. And you know how much I love Steph's game and the way he plays. It's just that one is 6'8", 250 pounds, and can affect the game offensively, defensively, scoring, passing, rebounding. Steph's a remarkable shooter, and he's way better in some other areas than he's given credit for. He puts up very respectable rebounding numbers and really good assist numbers in a lot of games, and just his mere presence opens up so many things because of the unusual ways teams have to defend him 30 feet from the basket, but he's still 6'3 and 185 pounds. So, you know, everybody can have their opinion on this. I still think LeBron is the more dominant player, but I thought Steph was a very deserving unanimous MVP because of the way he played from the first game of the year till the 82nd game of the year. He was out there giving it his all. LeBron picked and chose his spots, and I think even LeBron would admit that he was doing things with a bigger picture in mind. Now we're at that big picture, and we'll just see how it all plays out.
Yeah, no question about it. And at the end of the day, this is what sports is. You know, we crown champions, and then we talk about which champions were the best champions. You know, which teams were the best teams, and which players were the best players after it's all said and done. And while it's hard to do that on the career scale yet, because LeBron's story isn't yet finished being written, that's what people are talking about. And in our business and in sports writing, and certainly in sports broadcast and doing opinion-based talk shows like I do, that's what people are talking about. That LeBron James, if he doesn't get this one, it will be three straight finals defeats. No matter
Correct.
The circumstances, people aren't going to say, yeah, but this guy was hurt, that guy was hurt. This year was against a team that had 73 wins, blah, blah, blah. They're just going to see it in history, in the context of history, as three straight defeats in the finals. And overall, 2-7 in a category or a statistic, if you will, you know, a snapshot of a career that will be measured against 5-4 in 9 finals
right.
for Magic, 5-2
right.
in 7 finals for Kobe, 3-2 for Larry Bird, and on down to 6-4 for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, 5-1 for Tim Duncan, and then, of course, the immaculate 6-0 of Mike. At 2-5, that's when people are going to start to say, you know, he was great, he was an all-timer, but he wasn't an all-time finisher. In the last series of the year, when it was time to grab the brass ring like all of the others did more times than not, he didn't. And that's why I wonder, how personally will he take all of that onto the court going into this? Will he try to be the dominant force that he was, you know, in his, you know, before he started to maybe lose a step or so because of age and number of games and minutes played. Yeah. Really go out there and think this is, you know, this is domination time. This isn't be passive time.
Yeah, you know, in 2 weeks, Bob, isn't it amazing how much different we will look at 2 and 5 or 3 and 4?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's only one championship, but it's a trend if it continues on the losing end, and his legacy is kind of, I think, cemented a bit, a decent bit, if the Cavs win this thing. You can bet every last penny you have that LeBron is fully aware of all this. He knows the game. He knows its history. He knows how many titles all these other players have won, whether he wants to admit it or not. And he knows, you know, that there's going to be a ton of fallout if the Cavs lose again this year. They're a healthy team, by the so-called best player in the world, and they have to get it done. I'm curious too as to see how he plays, because I think it's in the Cavs' best interest if he continues to play the way he has, and that's to get Kevin Love going early, to let Kyrie have his run, and then to fill in the blanks and be confident enough in himself to know that he can do that whenever needed. But there's a lot of pressure to put up big numbers along with dominating this series. I think a win, Bob, in this series cures all, whether he averages 24 or 34. And a loss probably doesn't cure anything.
Right.
He could average 36 again like he does last year. But if his team comes out on the short end, he starts to enter that Chamberlain era where, yeah, you put up great numbers, but your team didn't win. And it must be something you did or didn't do that prevented that from happening. So,
And that's kind of, Rick, why we're talking to Rick Nolan, covers the Cavaliers for a couple of different newspapers out in Lorain County and the Cleveland area. Always kind of him to join us here in Toledo. You know, he took a high volume of shots to put up those massive numbers in the finals last year. And in some circles was criticized for it, but others then said, what else was he going to do? I mean, you know, without Love and without Kyrie there, you can't expect him to just put the ball in the hands of Mozgov and Dellavedova and say, here, you go score. So he put up a ton of shots. That's kind of where I'm going with this. Does he go back to that I've got to do it all mode if Love doesn't get off to the good start? And if he starts to see that pattern, oh, crap, his jumper isn't on today. And if Kyrie isn't doing it, and if he's having an off night, I'm going to go back to playing the ball I had to play last year. My guys are healthy now, but if they're not on, I can't sit around and wait for them.
Yeah, well, we can talk more about Love in a minute because this is going to be a very difficult series for him, I think, just because of matchups. But I think LeBron has a lot of confidence, and justifiably so, and that Kyrie is just a scorer, and he's going to get points. So I don't think he feels like he has to doubt Kyrie if he has a rough stretch. He's seen enough of him, and I think Kyrie has LeBron's complete faith that he can produce offensively.
As he should. So, I mean, because Kyrie has proven it time and again. He had the one bad game and then like a half, right, against Toronto in 3, and then the first half of game 4, he wasn't exactly on fire. Those are the only times where he looked like he was in a Love kind of funk. Remember, they combined for 4 for 28 in game 3.
Right,
but I agree
right.
with you. Kyrie has proven that he is a consistent scorer, and LeBron is going to certainly be able to trust that.
Yeah, and, you know, Love's an entirely different story for a number of reasons, you know, foremost being that while he and his teammates continue to insist it's not the case, his confidence ebbs and flows very quickly. In tough stretches. His psyche is fragile. LeBron knows this. And that's why he does his very best to get Kevin Love going early in games, because a good Kevin Love at the beginning usually will fight through the rest of the game for you And a bad Kevin Love tends to wander off to behind the three-point line and start passing up shots and sometimes doesn't even rebound. So, and on top of that, you have the issue of who is Kevin Love going to guard in this series once Golden State goes small.
That's a good transition. I wanted to get into the matchups to talk about that, so let's do that. Not just Kevin Love either. By the way, I was just looking up the stats at LeBron last year. You mentioned the 30 in the finals, 35.8, rebounds 13.3, assists 8.8. It was so close to a triple-double series.
Yes, unbelievable numbers.
It's incredible. But do you know how many shots, do you remember, how many shots per game he took to get that?
I don't, but my guess is going to be 24, 25-ish.
Oh, my God, Rick. That's why the reason I asked is because I was as shocked about this as I think you're going to be when you hear it. He took 196 shots in those six games. That translates to 32.6 per.
Yeah, I'm not real good at math, but I know that's 30-plus.
Yeah, I mean, I would have thought like you did 24, 25 shots, but boy, that's...
I didn't remember it being that high volume. You know, the last time I looked this year, and this was with two games left to go into this in the Toronto series, I think he was taking 17.5 shots a game, which was the second lowest of his playoff career. And he was averaging second lowest points of his playoff career for a season. Now, it went up the last two games because he did a little more. He's now leading the team in scoring. But if he's taken, more than 25 shots in this series, Bob, I think it's a pretty good indication that the rest of the Cavs are in a bad way.
Yeah, that Love has gone cold, or that J.R. Smith, which we know can be good J.R. or bad J.R., he's either going to be 7 for 10 from 3 or he's going to be 1 for 11. Either way, he's going to take that 10 or 11. It's his thing. And if they're not dropping, you know, like I said, that 33 shots a game that we just mentioned, I don't fault him for any one of them because of the circumstances.
No.
He had to do what he had to do, and let's just hope it doesn't come to that this year. Let's talk defense now, because you talked about Kevin Love and who he's going to guard. What I want to know is who's going to guard Steph, especially given, you know, here's the odd part about this is I'm sure you realize Kyrie has been condemned a bit this year for not being the best defensive player, and I think he'll admit that he had some runs of the season where he really wasn't even putting in the effort, maybe. But you couple that with, or contrast that with, I guess, game one last year before he blew out the kneecap, he was playing exceptionally well against Steph Curry. He was defending him. He was lighting him up for points. He had a big block on him, I think, toward the end of the first half. And it was like, man, Kyrie is playing with the MVP and outplaying him, quite frankly. Now, I don't know if that would have lasted six or seven games, but for a short while, we saw some good stuff. So what does Ty Lue do here? Do you just say, you know, Kyrie, you're going to start out on Steph and do your thing?
I think that's what they'll do to start. I think you're going to see a couple different things. First off, the Warriors have the luxury of being able to buy Steph a little bit of rest by having him defend JR because he doesn't post up, doesn't run through a lot of screens. So he's basically a standstill catch and shoot player. So they can afford to cross match and have a bigger Klay Thompson defend Kyrie. The Cavs don't have that luxury because Kyrie obviously can't guard Klay Thompson. He'll just take him down low a little bit and shoot 15-footers from the post. I think Kyrie will guard Steph at the beginning of game one tomorrow, and I think he'll guard him a decent amount of time. I think, though, that they'll look for every opportunity to have him guard someone else, be it Sean Livingston. What I wouldn't mind seeing, Bob, is have Kyrie guard Harrison Barnes and or Andre Iguodala at times during this series, and have either JR or LeBron guard Steph and have the other one guard Klay Thompson. Now, I know Harrison Barnes and Iguodala have a big size advantage on Kyrie, but neither of them is a very adept player in the post. They don't live down there. It's not their comfort zone. They're both more comfortable facing the basket. And even if it doesn't work, great. If they do get some touches inside and take advantage of it, at the very least, I think if the Warriors go to that, you've already changed the way they play. You've taken them away from a three-point shooting team and made them change a tiny bit. And while they might have some individual success at times, I think in the long run, that benefits the Cavs if they're limiting Steph and Klay Thompson from behind the arc. So to answer your question, I think anybody and everybody is going to guard Steph in this series, starting with Kyrie, but then becoming anyone from Dele to Shumpert to JR to even LeBron, I think you will see on him down the stretch of one or two possession games. I think LeBron could very well be guarding Steph.
What about Kevin Love? How do you hide him? Yeah. You can't hide him, but I mean, you know, he's got to do something here. But it's just a bad matchup defensively.
It is.
For the
Cavs. It is. And not only is it a bad matchup defensively, it's not a matchup that I'm real confident he can exploit offensively, because Draymond Green will give him fits if Kevin Love tries to post up, and we've seen Kevin Love kind of struggle to score in a low post all year, even against single coverage. He'll obviously, I think, start on Bogut for as long as he plays, which may not be a ton, because that allows him to stay closer to the basket and capitalize on his defensive rebounding, which is one of the biggest strengths of his game, and allows Tristan to play a little bit more on the perimeter, where he's better at switching and guarding smaller guys. But when the Warriors go to the lineup we all know they're going to go to, and that's Draymond at center, with everybody spreading the floor, nobody really in the key at all, and running pick and roll or driving and kicking, that's going to be tough for Kevin Love. You know, Draymond Green's going to be the biggest guy on the floor, at that stretch. Maybe you can put Kevin Love on Harrison Barnes, but, they'll just go stand in the corner and they'll play with the other four guys, and Love's 23 feet from the basket and not really helping you on the board.
That's why I'd rather have him on Green. Because Green, it's not that he can't shoot threes, but he doesn't take a ton of them. He doesn't take a ton. He's not going to be the standing in the corner, as you say, that Barnes would. He'll be moving around, and he'll be going in, and it will give Love an opportunity to slide off of him when shots go up and hit the glass, rather than being so far away from it. So.
But he has really struggled in that matchup because of the momentary help you have to give on those screen and rolls to the guard, to then recover and get back. Draymond he gets an angle to the basket where it allows him either to go all the way to the hole and finish, or creates another help situation on the other side of the court where they're then going to be playing 3-on-2. It's a big conundrum for the Cavs to solve in regards to Kevin Love.
No,
and I might add, you know, they're not going to do any better with Channing Frye in that situation either, because he's not any better of a defender than Kevin Love.
No, he's a great option if Love's jumper isn't falling early and he starts to get, as you say, that mentally fragile state of his. You can go to him and go to Frye and you know, maybe have a better chance at getting some offense there. But you're right, it's pick your poison when it's on the defensive end with those two guys. Rick Nolan, really, really great breakdown as always, as we talk not only the championship round between the Cavs and the Warriors, but also the LeBron-Steph thing. It is a really, really a clash of the two greatest players in the league right now. And somebody's going to come out of this saying, I told you I was the greatest player in the league. And that's a big deal. I'm not going to ask you to pick yet because it's not until tomorrow. I'm sure you're going to make an announcement in the paper. I will look for it there as you make your prediction. And then I'd love to have you back on to do some analysis after we get a couple of games in. Sound good?
Sounds good. It's going to be a phenomenal series. I've actually been looking forward to it all season, and I just can't wait to see how it all unfolds.
I totally agree with you, Rick. Rick, great stuff. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk to you down the road, and I will see you in the newspaper, all right?
Sounds good.
Thank you, Rick. Rick Nolan joining us from Cleveland. He is not in Oakland, but he has been on the beat for the Cavs for, as he said, 30 years, and he's seen a little bit of everything. All right, we're going to go from that side to the other side. The Golden State Warriors, pride of the Bay Area. We're going to the Bay, San Francisco. An old friend of mine, a talk show host named Damon Bruce, is going to join us next to talk about it from the Dubs side of things as we continue on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
All you're doing is allowing all these other people that we spend all of our time at the NCAA saying, you can't recruit through a third party. You can't be involved with third party people. And that's exactly what you're doing. Creating all these third parties that's going to get involved with the prospects and all that. And then who gets exposed on that? I go to a camp and I'm talking to some guy, I don't know, from Adam's house cat. And he's representing some kid because he put the camp on. And then I'm in trouble for talking to this guy? I'm just saying it's bad for college football. Jim Harbaugh can do whatever he wants to do. I'm not saying anything bad about him. He thinks that's what's best. There needs to be somebody that looks out for what's best for the game, not what's best for the Big Ten or not what's best for the SEC or not what's best for Jim Harbaugh, but what's best for the game of college football.
Well, Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh fired back at Saban's comments with this tweet. Amazing to me. Alabama broke NCAA rules, and now their head coach is lecturing us on the possibility of rules being broken at camps. Truly amazing.
The 1-1. Fly ball left field, way back and gone.
Are you kidding me?
An absolute no-doubter to left. C.J. Crone's up for the game. He had three for the season coming in, and the Angels walk it off. Tigers had rallied from seven runs down to tie with home run power. The Angels win it on a walk-off by Crone with another home run.
Can't make this up.
Not my concern. I don't get involved in all that underdog, overdog, whatever the case may be. It's stupidity. For me, it's just how well I can get my team prepared mentally and physically to go out for battle. It's going to be a tough test for us, and we know that. We're better built to start the finals than we were last year. It doesn't matter who it's against.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Come on, LeBron. Don't tell me it doesn't matter who it's against. It matters a big, 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 in a big way. It matters a great deal to you. You know that. I know that. And everybody knows that the subplot to this finals, LeBron and Steph, Steph and LeBron, who's the real best player at the NBA, is almost as big as the finals itself. Hour number two underway. You just heard, of course, a little bit from Nick Saban, a little bit back from Jim Harbaugh, some baseball, too. We'll get into all of that stuff in a while, but we want to stay focused on the NBA Finals because the rematch is obviously set. It begins tomorrow. Kyrie Love. Yeah, there you go. All right, that's fine. Kyrie Love and Kevin Irving are ready to rock. Kyrie doesn't have one shattered kneecap this time around. Well, it happened in game one last time. He's fully healthy. He's playing the best basketball of his career. He is in sync with LeBron James like he has not been since they were put together last year. Kevin Love, it is a mystery from night to night. He's either an all-pro who doesn't miss, or he is mentally checked out and he's gone. Will they be enough to reverse last season's end result and bring their first championship of any sport to the city of Cleveland for the first time in 52 years? That's what we're waiting to see. And standing in the way, the Golden State Warriors, who are proudly represented this afternoon by an old friend of mine from my years, about 15 years ago now. It's hard to believe. That's going to make you feel old, Damon Bruce. In San Francisco, Damon Bruce is a talk show host in San Francisco for 95.7 The Game. D. Bruce is all in on his Dubs, and he joins us now to talk a little bit about the matchup right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. D. Bruce, how you doing? Good, sir.
Bob, they still let you out of the house unmedicated. What a great day for you. That is phenomenal. First of all, it's been so long since I've talked to you. It's great to hear your voice again. We bumped into each other very early on in my career. You were a great guy to me, and it really is. It's good to be on with you. I had no idea I would be representing the Golden State Warriors. I hope they send me a paycheck for this if I'm going to do PR for them. But
you've been doing PR for them, brother. You've been doing PR for them on Twitter the entire season. You're a hysterical follow, by the way.
73 wins is easy to promote, Bob. This has been one of the most amazing things in the world. If I'm coming off as homerish, it's because I'm in awe of what I've just seen this team go through. What they've just gone through in the Western Conference Finals was really one of the more historic sporting events in Bay Area history, and there's a lot of history around here. You know it very well. So it's something else what we're going through, and the Sharks in the Stanley Cup. I mean, these are the salad days, and we actually eat salads out here in California.
Damon Bruce is our guest, 95.7 The Game out in San Francisco. Damon, you and I, and you're right. I mean, it's like I said before, it's hard to believe. It was very early in your career, and you have obviously built a tremendous career for yourself over the last 15 years, or 14, I guess, since I last saw you. But what is going on right now is historic. You and I watched, and you have watched, obviously, being a lifer out there. Well, no, I take that back, because you went to Indiana. Are you from the Midwest? Are you from the Bay, but just went to the Midwest?
Yeah, born in Chicago, raised in New York, went to college at IU, and then have been out here for a total of like 18 years now. Like, once you cross that 12-year threshold, you can say you're from the Bay Area. You can. I'm not a lifer, but I will be. How about that?
Fair enough. And that's all I've ever known you as. So I'm trying to point out, though, that you have seen so much there. You've seen Niners championships. You've seen Giants World
Series
championships.
Yes, but I want your audience to know that I have my Midwestern sensibilities about me. Yes, I do.
Indeed you do. But here's what's crazy, D. Bruce, when I say you've been repping them on Twitter, not just this year. And you're right, 73 is very easy to promote. But I remember a tweet that you sent, and I don't know why, but it was last year, and it was in like November, because they got off to a tremendous start last year too. Not like this year's record setting. What was it? What was it before they lost? 26?
24 now.
I don't remember exactly what last year's was, but they were something like 20 something and one maybe, or and you tweeted something to the effect of, "Hey, look, 80-2 is still out there. Just saying." And I just thought, geez, you remember tweeting that?
I do. I was just joking around.
I know
about
you were,
it,
but D. Bruce, everybody knew it was a joke. But I thought, man, D. Bruce, that's a little pompous, fady. You know? But then they went 73-9 a year later. Man, you weren't far off for joking around. They had single digit losses, for crying out loud. Nobody has ever done that before, and you were like way out ahead of the game, a year ahead, in fact.
Look, I went to Indiana. We know basketball in Bloomington. Uh-huh. We really do. And I think my basketball eyes affixed to this team told me that something very special was happening. I mean, all of it last year was too much too soon. This is not how basketball works. And when people say the Warriors broke basketball, I guess one of the things they mean is that normally you got to knock on the door several times before you're allowed into the club. The Warriors showed up and went right to the front of the line of the club and looked like they belonged there the entire time. And so I really had great expectations for them coming into the season. I thought that they would flirt with breaking the Chicago Bulls record, and indeed that's exactly what happened. I mean, it's nice to know that I can be right about something in sports for a change, especially when I'm trying to be positive. And I know that I'm going to be accused of selling the team's lemonade for them. But I love basketball. I really do. And I've never seen a basketball team play like this, function like this. I've never seen a team built quite like this, and it's really something to watch from the, I mean, just the, you know, the Mike Dunleavy, Troy Murphy days to this. I mean, it's really something
else.
Well,
when I was there, Chris Mullen was just named the GM, I think, and it was what, Jason Richardson. They had their own. They had their little core of not bad players. Jason Richardson, and I'm trying to remember who else was there.
They bet way too much on Monte Ellis and Andres Biedrinch.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about. So you're right. You have seen it go from gutter to penthouse like in a blink. And you're right. They didn't have to wait in line, and that is kind of a trippy thing. Aside from what they've built, Damon, we're talking to Damon Bruce, 95.7 The Game out there in San Francisco. Aside from what they've built from a talent standpoint, which is obviously amazing, the shooting on this team, the philosophy that they've put together, it is incredible. But from the motivational side of things, we hear in national media a lot, and we speculate a lot about how the Warriors took it personally, that some people said that they didn't really earn a championship last year because they got breaks every step of the way. They didn't have to play the best team in the West. Then they get injuries to key players on everybody that they beat, and all the way to the finals, and then bang, Love is already out, and out goes Kyrie. Did they really take it personally, and was that a motivating factor this year to say, you know what, screw you guys who said our championship was somehow less than impressive because of our competition and those circumstances, or is that just overblown by national media?
Bob, it's real. It's real. There's no doubt there was a chip on. You don't win 73 games without a chip on your shoulder. If that's not a we're here to prove something sports statement, I mean, I really don't know what is. So there's no doubt it was a huge motivation all year. I don't think it bothered them when all the old timers came out and, you know, like, oh no, what, you know, what, What does, you know, Alex English think about the Warriors? Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, it really, you know, this is a team that has been focused with a chip on its shoulder, and I think it's been a great asset for them. Whether the NBA helped place it there or not, the national media, the echoes, maybe they're even their own doubts and knowledge of how the NBA works and that they kind of got away with a few breaks. They really did. And teams don't need to apologize for another team's circumstances. You know, I mean, it's a shame what happened to the Cavaliers. No one wants to see the finals play out like that, but it did. And I'm glad that we're going to get it healthy this time around. There's a lot of different things to talk about from last year's finals to this year's finals. And I'll tell you my favorite storyline in just a little bit, but there's no doubt that this is a team that played with a chip on its shoulder, and it's tough to win a title and get hungrier. It really is in sports, in professional sports.
And they did that.
You got to give them credit.
I do, and I get where the chip comes from. But yet, I don't regret, because I was one of, not that they hurt me, but I mean, I was one of the many in the country who said, man, do these guys just have the basketball gods owing them favors or what? Because everything, not just through last year's title and the final, based on what we just discussed with the Cavs injuries, but even this year, you know, round one against a Rockets team that is so dysfunctional. James Harden ended up getting two coaches fired, essentially, in one season. Dwight Howard, Harden couldn't play together to save their lives. It was pretty much the easiest first-round matchup anybody had. But that's
right,
okay.
But I mean, come on,
you're the first seed.
But, Bob, there's a wet spot on the floor that nearly takes the MVP's knee out. I mean, this was not like
hold that thought. That's my point about this, DeBruce, because at the time that the injury finally strikes Steph and things go against the Warriors, and I'm looking into the second or into the second round now, they should be set to face Chris Paul without Steph Curry. They should be set to face Blake Griffin without Steph Curry, the MVP. A very talented, and we know about there's a big rivalry and animosity between the Warriors and the Clippers. And both Paul and Griffin go down and can't even get out of that series because of their two stars going down. And it's like the gods of basketball looked and said, no worry, Dubs, we're going to give you the Blazers, the upstart Blazers, who with four new starters this year shouldn't even be here, so you can play them without Steph Curry for three or four games. You're not going to play a much better team. So it seemed like it was all happening again until the conference finals when they played, and obviously the incredible comeback against the full-strength Oklahoma City Thunder.
I mean, if that doesn't make you a believer now, what will? I mean, that's the thing. If you have your doubts, if you're saying it's circumstantial that the Warriors are here, if that coming roaring back from 3-1 down in the Western Conference Finals against a really, really good Thunder team that has a duo that is as good as any duo that any basketball team has anywhere in the world, I mean, if that doesn't make you a believer now, Bob, what will?
By taking out the Cavaliers
in six, will that make you a believer? Because that's what's about to happen, by the way.
I gave them all the credit in the world while also simultaneously giving the Thunder all of the grief in the world for that incredible choke job, by the way, which was very Cleveland-like, to be honest with you, when they blew that 3-1 lead to your Warriors. But I do, because it was the first time in these 2 years that they faced a premium opponent that was at full strength, and I was sitting here watching them get knocked off, down 3-1. I said, see what happens when you face somebody strong? The title last year was kind of a little bit tainted because they didn't have to do that. But then they came back from 3-1, and especially when they somehow found the gear that Oklahoma State didn't have, and maybe they found the composure in the final 5 minutes of game six to take that over and win that. That's when I said, you know what? You can't say anything anymore about the circumstances that led to their title and to their place right now. They just proved against a great team that there's a reason why they won 73 games.
Yeah, no, this is real. This is really happening. This is not an optical illusion. This is not a drill or a dress rehearsal. This is a team that is on the verge of, I think, not just winning back-to-back titles, but maybe 5 of 7. I mean, that's where this is. That's how ahead of the curve in the league they are. With a weapon that no one else can really roll out. I mean, I know that the Cavaliers have been shooting three very, very well as of late, a ton of them. But if Cleveland's plan to beat the Warriors is to get into a three-point shooting contest against them, like, good luck. Have fun with
them. That's their game, and I certainly hope that is not what the Cavaliers plan to do. But you said they've got a weapon the Warriors do to roll out that nobody else does. And I said a pair of them. Klay Thompson, when Steph wasn't at his best, for example, in Game 6, Klay Thompson, and he almost pulled it out for them in Game 4, too, the way he shot the basketball. And what did he score, 19 straight points, I think, at one point in the third quarter, took a huge double-digit deficit and cut it to, like, 7. His marksmanship, and he's one of these underrated guys, and I know he made All-NBA, so how do you call him underrated? But I guess because he plays with Steph, he's still just the other guy. Klay Thompson is just a phenomenal, you know, top 15, maybe higher NBA player, no matter what your measuring stick is.
Yeah, if you're using defense in the equation as well, I think he leaps into the top 10. I think he's the best two guard in all of basketball. I mean, he's the best two-way player, maybe. Not named LeBron James in terms of what he can do offensively and defensively, because he is in front of the other team's best backcourt player every single night on important defensive possessions. I told you what the difference, the biggest difference, you know, all what's going on between last year's finals, this year's, the health, Kevin Love being focused, Tyronn Lue, whatever, like whatever the Cavaliers' differences are, that's all on the table and it's all legit. And Fry can hit the three, and like all that's real. Klay Thompson is a killer now, Bob. He's a killer.
Yes, he
Klay
is.
Thompson is Jack the Ripper. Klay Thompson is all grown up. It is this is the guy who would be the best shooter on the planet, but for his teammate.
Damon,
that's who Klay Thompson is.
We're talking to Damon Bruce. D. Bruce is an afternoon radio show host in San Francisco at 95.7 The Game, a big-time Warriors fan, obviously, and a tremendous talk show talent. Damon, I've been a Kevin Durant fan forever, and I loved the way that Durant and Westbrook played, especially in building that 3-1 lead. And I thought there is no way they could possibly blow this. But the bottom line is, at the end of this series, those last three games, Durant and Westbrook, widely regarded as two of the top five players in the NBA, were outplayed by Steph and Klay. And I'm not saying that makes them two of the top five, but honestly, Steph Curry and Klay combined to outplay those two phenomenal players. And it wasn't like, just Steph the MVP. It was probably equal billing. I know Steph made more of the shots in Game 7, the clincher, but when they needed it the most, when Steph wasn't doing his thing, and people were saying, gee, you think Steph is injured? Is he still bothered by the injury, I should say? It was Klay, and those two guys proved to be the best duo in the NBA, at least over those two guys, and I don't know, maybe LeBron James and Kyrie Irving, the way they have played in these playoffs, might have an argument there, but I think Curry and Klay have earned every bit of accolades that you can throw at them.
Yeah. They're the real deal, and what makes this team so dangerous is it's never about just one or two guys or the big three or the star nucleus or the constellation or whatever you want to call your group of stars, whatever. I mean, they really are a deep basketball team. Sean Livingston gives this team so much. Andre Iguodala, as Cleveland fans know very well, gives this team so very much confidence and just know-how when it comes to making the right decision on a basketball court when it matters most, that's why they close quarters and halves so well, because they continue to play all together and on the same page when things start getting chaotic. They really thrive in chaos, and there's a beautiful art form to it. I mean, that's where great basketball happens, on the edge of losing control a little bit. And I've never seen a team get out on that edge and play there and sustain that moment of being on the edge as well as this team has against as good a competition as this team faces night in, night out, in the Western Conference. You know, one of the conversations we have all the time is, what would the Warriors' record have been if they're an Eastern Conference team this year? Like, what do you think the difference in conferences is good for in just a win total? Like, if you think that the West is 5 wins better than the Eastern Conference, 5 wins tougher, that means the Warriors are like a 78-win team in the Eastern Conference.
There's an interesting dynamic there, because I, like most people, have, of course, been talking about the unbelievable superiority of the Western Conference over the East, and certainly it played out last year that way. And the teams at the top of the West, That continues to be the case. In other words, the best teams in the West, the Warriors, the Thunder, the Clippers, the Spurs, they are certainly better than the top four, for example, of the East by a lot. Depth-wise, though, going, you know, top to bottom, that gap got closed considerably this year. Jim Cushlin, our producer, is here with us as well, because he talked about this earlier, and it is true that last year, I think, didn't three of the Eastern Conference playoff teams last year have below 500 records?
No, it was two. I think the Bucks were at 500.
I mean, it was brutal. And the East top teams still are brutal compared to the West top teams. But from the standpoint of just top to bottom, if you had to play that schedule of teams more often than the Western schedule of teams, I don't know that the gap is as big as maybe it would have been a year ago.
Right. I mean, it's a top-heavy conference, not as deep as it used to be. The talent pool is a little more shallow at the bottom. That's for sure. Okay. There are a few reasons for it. You know, Anthony Davis and the Pelicans not coming together, I guess, is a reason for it. The Houston Rockets being just in their Houston malaise is a reason for that.
The Grizzlies took a step back big time.
Right. The Clippers always disappointing you is a reason for that. But you had three teams that could win the NBA title in this conference, in Oklahoma City, San Antonio, and Golden State. And only one team in the Eastern Conference a real argument could go on and win an NBA title. So
no question about it.
It is more top-heavy, but the puddle's not nearly as deep as it used to be.
Hey, this is a different, totally different topic, but I just got to ask you, be honest with me, would you please? The kick between the goalposts of Steven Adams. Intentional?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm really surprised that he was not suspended again. And I guess that answers my question.
Okay. And I was.
That is your question. It answers your question.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I agree with you, D. Bruce. I really think he should have been. And I was surprised when they upgraded it to a flagrant two after, which, you know, if they call it a flagrant two on the spot, you reject it. You miss the next 3.5 quarters.
And I figured that they would give him a ceremonial. You should have missed court time. So now we're going to give it to you. The upgrade to the foul and then the fine without the suspension just doesn't follow the logical bouncing ball. It really doesn't. Warriors caught a break there, for sure.
Now, from a rule standpoint, he still is on the same bubble, right? He's one flagrant foul. This is still considered the same playoff season. If he gets a flagrant one even, he automatically does get suspended.
He is two technical fouls away from an automatic suspension, one flagrant.
Gotcha. Okay, now let's talk about matchups here, okay, as we get into this thing. Well, you know what? Before we talk about matchups, because I'm going to ask you to do something nobody has probably asked you to do before in a second. The subplot here, the LeBron versus Steph, last year during the finals, and I believe it was before game five, and LeBron was asked, are you nervous, are you worried? And he said, why would I be worried? I'm the best player in the world. It was a statement that wasn't accidental. It was a message, too. I don't care if Steph just won the MVP. I'm the best player in the world. This year, Steph gets the unanimous MVP, and LeBron is asked about it. And he praises Steph, says, hey, sure, he deserves that award. He shot 90-50-40, led the league in steals, just tremendous season. Yeah, he deserves that award. But you know what? When you talk about most valuable player and you have to define what valuable is, you know, there is a difference. And that was his way, again, of saying, you can give him whatever award you want. I'm still the best player in the world. And I think secretly he absolutely wanted this opportunity again to go head-to-head with Steph rather than face the Thunder to prove that. So do you think that'll be a driving, motivating factor at all for either one of those guys? And second of all, who is, in Damon Bruce's mind, the best player in the world?
I've said this, and I think I got this. I think you're going to agree with this. LeBron James is the default setting of best basketball player on the planet. Mm-hmm. And it takes an outlier, a truly historically remarkable, almost mathematically breaking the equation type of performance to trump his default setting. Steph Curry's thrown down two of those performances in the last 2 years, and I think has properly been named MVP in the last 2 years. But LeBron is the default setting of true basketball scary. I really believe that. I saw Steph Curry asked about this in a press conference today already, you know, wrestling the title of face of the NBA away from LeBron James. And, you know, Steph said, look, when I go out on the basketball court, it's to win games. It's not to be the face of the NBA. I think LeBron James does things to be the face of the NBA. He is desirous of that title. Steph doesn't even really want it. but it's being handed to him. It's being forced and thrust upon him by media, by fans, by global interest, and by curiosity. So he is a true outlier, Steph Curry. We've never seen anything like him before. And LeBron James used to fit that billing and title of we've never seen anything like him before.
Yeah,
but we've seen LeBron plenty now. Yeah, we've seen him plenty now. We're used to him, and Steph is this brand new shiny thing. So of course the attention is his.
Do you think that Steph and the Warriors as a whole are good for basketball? And I'll ask that with two quick subtexts to it. One is the league is turning into, I mean, you pointed out, look what the Cavaliers started doing, particularly in the Hawks series, setting it, breaking the Warriors NBA record for most threes in a game, and then setting the record for most threes in a four-game series in a sweep. The game has just changed. The three-point shot, I mean, it changed it when it first came in, of course, but the way the Warriors have used it as a weapon, other teams are forced to kind of do the same thing. Is that good for basketball at the NBA level? And the second subtext to that is, Damon, my son, who's 12, made a seventh grade, his CYO seventh grade all-star team. And the all-star game that they played in, and he played in it last year to his sixth graders, and they played it like basketball. But this year, one kid took a Steph Curry-esque 6 feet behind the three-point line shot and drained it. The rest of the game, both teams, that's all they did was try to out-Curry one another. And they would literally shoot them yelling Curry with their hand up as they got back down the court. Kids are learning
okay,
the
that's
game
bad
a very
coaching.
Different way.
Okay,
so what is your thought on what it does to the game? Go ahead.
That's bad coaching. Tell those kids to get inside the three-point line, quit jacking up those deep shots, unless you're Steph Curry. You know, this is one of those do as we say, not as we do
well,
basketball
you know that's
teams.
What they do. That's the thing. You know that. If they could dunk, they would go up there and try to do spectacular
sure.
dunks, but they can't. So, you know what? This little 6'3" guy who isn't much bigger than my dad can do this. You know what? Anybody
not
can
right.
do what
I love
at. And
I,
it's
I,
just I, the, it's just what it's done to the kids, but.
I love it, but that's the thing. But it's, you know, it's like, it's not Steph Curry and the Warriors' job to raise your kids
anymore
than it is Sony's
or Deadpool
or anything.
I'm not saying he should change anything because he's the greatest shooter in history. I wouldn't change a thing either. I'm not suggesting.
Here's the thing, Bob.
But I'm just wondering, how do you like it? Do you like that development of the game?
Well, here's the thing. I've always loved great shooters. I've always told lousy shooters to shoot less. Like, nothing changes. Like, nothing, that's never changed. Like, you shouldn't shoot like this unless you can shoot like this. And there are very few people in the world who can shoot like this. The Warriors just happen to have two of them.
Do you miss the mid-range jump shot, though, because of the
no, overemphasis on the no, no! Look, I mean, basketball's about shooting. This basketball's about shooting. I mean, I never understood in this whole, like, well, I don't know if Steph Curry's skill set would translate throughout the history of shooting. From the day they hung the peach baskets, the guy who could shoot well was valuable. I mean, come on. I don't understand this whole, like, well, there's too much shooting. There used to be too much dunking. Remember that? Remember that was the, oh, well, this all it is just too much guys attacking the rim. Look, too many guys attacking the rim is what lost us gold medals in global competition.
That is true.
The shot is an art form that these guys are bringing back into style. Now, their art form is better than the pedestrian art form, like all art forms. These guys are professionals, but they're not ruining basketball. They're doing what they do better than everyone else. And what's crazy, what drives coaches crazy, what drives viewers and talk show hosts crazy, I think, sometimes, is to defend the Golden State Warriors. You now have to be out on a place on the court that your entire life you've been coached not to even play or defend.
Exactly right.
And
that is
that's
exactly
why they're
right.
breaking the game.
You've led into my last question for you, D. Bruce, because we're already way late here, and I really appreciate the conversation. I knew it would
this
be fun.
This is fun. This is like a podcast. No commercials. This is
I know. I've blown past my sports center at the bottom of the hour and everything else. It's crazy, and they're going to kill me for it. But I have to ask one final question that you probably haven't been asked, and you kind of just led into it. I was going to ask you to coach my team for me. Coach, the Cleveland Cavaliers, if you were in that huddle, and you've been watching the Warriors for 82 games plus now throughout the playoffs too, if you were coaching the Cleveland Cavaliers, you know what the talent level is, you know who the players are, how would you defend these Warriors?
I'm beating Steph Curry off the ball every time. He is running through a minefield to get open on screens. You bully Steph Curry everywhere he goes, and then You rebound the basketball, and you pound the Warriors inside. You get Bogut in foul trouble. You get Azeli in foul trouble, and you pound the Golden State Warriors. You slow them down, and you pound on them. I still haven't seen Steph Curry delivered once the, oh, my God, how dare you ever foul the MVP that hard foul. I put Steph Curry in a body bag if I'm the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Didn't it look like the Thunder did that? Not that one like you're talking about,
that
one massive one, but they banged them around like a ping pong ball in games 3 and 4.
That's why that thing went 7, Bob. They put bodies on him. You lean on the Warriors hard. You try to get under Draymond. I tell Dellavedova, look, I know you're not guarding the guy, but you get in Draymond Green's ear and you be Draymond Green's like alter ego. You pester him everywhere. You try to get under Draymond Green's skin and rattle him, and you get Bogut off the court if you can. I know Bogut is the one guy who was not happy with the finals last year. He didn't play a big role in it, and he wants to play a bigger role this year, and the Warriors will be better off for themselves if he can. He was a big part of that game 6 comeback in Oklahoma City. So you pound the Warriors. The LeBron that is going 11 of 13 from inside of 8 feet, that is the LeBron that is going to give the Warriors as much as they can possibly handle. Not the dribble out the shot clock, take an off-balance fadeaway from 14 feet. That LeBron goes
home. Which he has completely, finally, seems to have gotten rid of in his game in these playoffs. He has stopped doing that. He has taken fewer shots. He was content to let Kyrie lead the team in scoring in the playoffs for the first 3 rounds virtually. He finally, I think, took the lead points per game over in the last couple against Toronto. But yeah, he is not that guy anymore. At least he hasn't been, and I think that's a great thing for them. D-Bruce, last thing, Warriors in how many? I know you're picking the Warriors in how many?
Warriors in 6. I think they celebrate in Cleveland.
Wow. And they return that smell of champagne to the locker room that they referenced the last time they came in here this season.
And I'm sure everyone on Cleveland.com will get all upset about it. That's kind of what everyone there does.
Yes, they will, as well they should. Damon Bruce, talk show host out there at 95.7 The Game in San Francisco. Damon, it was really a lot of fun. I appreciate it. You know, there's a long series in front of us. Let's see how things go. And if there's a need to, let's do this again. Sound good?
Call me anytime, Bob. It was great catching up with you, man. You be well.
Thank you, brother. You got it. Have a good one. All right, we're way late. Let's get out and get a Sports Center and come back in and wrap this bad boy up right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, we continue right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Jim Cushlin here as well. Thanks to Damon Bruce joining us all the way out from the Bay Area. Thanks also to Rick Nolan, who joined us from Cleveland as we set you up for the NBA Finals game number 1 tomorrow night. Turning away from basketball, Cush, just a little bit and talk a little bit about baseball. Marlon Byrd gets the second strike, if you will, in the PED world for baseball. A full 162 games. That's what A-Rod got, right? A-Rod, didn't he have 162? No, he had 100.
Yeah, myself included, wanted 162, but there was a way they found out to not do that.
And I can't remember exactly what it was, but I thought he was suspended for... No. He had 211 games.
That was it, yeah, that was it.
And they reduced it to 162.
That's
right.
He did
get the full 162. His was 211, and I can't remember the circumstance. It doesn't matter. The whole point about this thing with Marlon Byrd, you know, it's great. This is one of these weird things, Jim. I hate, and you've heard me talk over and over and over again on this program, about how I don't want Roger Clemens ever in the Hall.
Right.
I don't want Bonds, all of those guys, all of these cheats ever disgracing the Hall of Fame and tainting the accomplishments of all of those who did it, in my view, it would taint the accomplishments of all those who did it right and put up the same kind of great numbers but did it legally.
Right, right.
I hate these guys. And yet part of me, just part of me, feels a little bit bad for Marlon Byrd. And here's the reason why. He's 38 years old. He's a guy who I think is different in the sense that he's not cheating in the prime of his career to out-homer everybody else and get massive contracts. Like Ryan Braun, for example, who won an MVP under false pretenses a couple of years ago with the Brewers. Then we find out he cheated. Then we find out his excuse was the chain of custody of the sample was broken, which means that he accused the person who took the test, then took the results.
I still find that part of it the worst aspect of the Braun story.
You remember that?
Yeah, of course I do.
He's a guy, though, that was in his prime and was considered to be one of the best power hitters in the game. He was trying to cheat his opponents in order to make more money, in order to hit more home runs, set more records, win more MVPs. I feel like a guy like Bird, and again, I should have no sympathy for him whatsoever if I'm being totally consistent with my view on this. He's 38 years old. He's a guy who's not trying to win home run contests. He's a guy who's not trying to make another huge contract. He's a guy who's just trying to hang on in the league. He's a guy who's just at the end of his career, and he's trying to stick a little bit longer. And maybe make another run with the team to go into the playoffs or something. Just a guy who's not letting go.
Right. Or as it was said in Bull Durham at the beginning to Crash, or you can keep going to ballparks and keep getting paid to do it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And then in which case I would have less sympathy if it's just about, like I said, the paycheck. But I mean, just, you know, he's a 38-year-old guy who's just trying to stay in the league, and he probably couldn't make a team, maybe, if he isn't able to, you know, to get a little bit of an edge here. He's hitting .270 with 5 home runs and 19 RBIs in 115 at-bats this year. So he's been, you know, moderately productive for the Indians, and certainly that will be gone now. And I think maybe one of the other reasons why I feel like maybe I have a small iota of sympathy for a guy I shouldn't is I read a tweet from Zach Meisel, our friend who covers the Indians.
Yes,
out there in Cleveland.
Yes.
And he quoted, and doggone it, it's not in front of me now. I think I closed the window. But he was quoting somebody who apparently heard Marlon Byrd say to a teammate, my career is over, and I didn't want to go out this way. In other words, he's 38. He's got to miss a full calendar year. He comes back, he's 39. Nobody's going to sign him. His career is over,
yeah.
And this is the way he's going to go out. I find a small, slight bit of, I don't know. Sympathy is the wrong word. That would mean I excuse his actions and behavior and in some way feel sorry for him. But I just have a little bit of tinge of that's a sad story, I guess, with me more than, you know, Bonds, who cheated because he knew that McGuire and Sosa were getting all of the love, saving baseball in 1998 with the great home run race. And here he is being the all around far superior player to either one of those two guys, and nobody's paying attention to him. Well, I'll show them. And he starts cheating. It was all outlined in the book, The Game of Shadows. You know, cheating basically to catch those guys and pass them up and all of their records and get the accolades and the adulation. How about that? Two words together. That he always craved. You know, a guy like Clemens, same thing. A guy like A-Rod. These guys are all-time greats already, and they're then juicing just to pass up the other all-time greats that juiced, essentially. And that bothers me a lot more than a guy like Marlon Byrd, who, and I'm not saying this because he's with the Indians. He could be with the Rays right now, and I wouldn't care. A guy who's just trying to hang on and still be in the league and still be relevant and not trying to break records, that sort of thing. I guess I just see it as a little bit differently.
And I kind of sort of understand where you're coming from, but at the end of the day, I can't join you there. I'm more upset about the fact that that's two on the same team in the same calendar season.
Oh, that's right, Abraham Almonte.
Yeah, and given that we're just past Morita, there's still like 30 games or something technically to go on that one, too. And I don't care if you're 39 or 38 in this case, like Bird, or if you're Bonds. You know, at this stage of everything,
the one
that you would think some of these guys would know better.
But right,
at this point,
right.
This isn't 2002 anymore.
And just so you know, when you say you're not sure you can go there with me, I'm not even sure I go there with me. I'm thinking out loud here, and I feel badly for a couple of reasons. But it's not like I think, oh, this is terrible. They shouldn't have suspended him. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is that it's a sad story to an end of a career that, you know, solid player, played a long time in the league, was never a superstar, was never going to be that, you know, that guy that we just talked about with the other guys, and this is how it's
sure.
going to go out. His comment, and I think I have it. Where is that quote from Zach? So I'm looking for the tweet from Zach that quoted Marlon Byrd, and apparently, here it is. It was Zach Meisel quoting Terry Francona, who said this to the media about Marlon Byrd. He basically told the guys that his career was over. He told his teammates that his career was over, and that's not how he wanted it to end. Meisel also reports that he started packing his belongings last night because he knew this was coming, and he is basically putting his gear away for the final time because he'll never be back in baseball again. That's just one of those things that's very, it's sad, it's disappointing. And then I would be lying if I didn't say it also bothered me because he's an Indian, and you mentioned Almonte, who might have made this team, also being suspended for what, 60? 50? 60. 60 games, I think, Abraham Almonte.
That, 80.
80 games.
Yeah,
oh,
that one was 80.
That's right, 80 games. And the reason why is, here's another tweet, just to throw it out there for you. The Indians' outfield now consists of Rajai Davis, Tyler Naquin, Lonnie Chisenhall, Jose Ramirez, Michael Martinez, and maybe you or me. Because Brantley's down, and now you had the moderately productive Bird gone. Almonte never made it here because of that. It is a bad situation for them all the way around. So just, Oh, and by the way, as far as the money you were talking about, especially since you went to the Bull Durham line.
Yeah.
Marlon Byrd earned about $38 million during his 15-year Major League Baseball career. $38 million in 15 years. This is a guy, again, who was never in Bonds, McGuire, or these other guys' territories, or Ryan Braun's territory. $38 million over 15 years, if my math isn't off, that's a little bit over $2 million a year. So that's the kind of player he was. He wasn't a guy who was, a big record setter who was trying to cheat to get a massive contract. He was a journeyman baseball player trying to hang on for a little while longer, and it's just a sad way to end it. Like I said, I don't have sympathy because that would indicate I condone PED use when I absolutely do not, but I just feel bad that the situation is where it is. So just wanted to throw that out there. We've done so much basketball the last couple of days. In fact, the last couple of weeks, obviously, as we get deeper and deeper into these NBA playoffs and out of the finals, there is a lot of good stuff, or interesting stuff, I should say, going on baseball-wise. Not really good when you talk about the two teams, the Tigers and the Indians, that our fans care about, both of whom are trying to avoid sweeps, as you said in your last update, Jim. But we do want to start getting back into the groove of some of those things. Didn't get a chance today to hit the Harbaugh and Nick Saban fight.
Oh, that's too funny. That's the comic relief we're going to have to use in the coming days.
It is very funny. That audio you played during the top of the last 2 hours, really, really good stuff. And I got a lot of strong thoughts on that, too. And I think a lot of them are going to make Nick Saban look really, really bad, to be quite frank. And I'm not just trying to be homerish or anything else and support Harbaugh or the Big Ten or anything else, but I think Saban just needs to shut up. He really does. Nick Saban,
I heard about like two or three contradictions in his whole thing that I played, I feel, already.
yeah. Yes, you did. Yes, you absolutely did. And you know what? It doesn't matter to him because his whole life, his whole career has been one contradiction. When he was the head coach at Miami with the Dolphins, and the reporters are asking him, where is you going to Alabama? Where is you going to Tuscaloosa? And I am not. I am the Miami Dolphins head coach. I guarantee you I will not be the Alabama head coach 3 months later. We would like to introduce our new head coach here, the Alabama Crimson Tide. I mean, the guy's life is one contradiction. You can't trust him. And I think it's really funny that Jim Harbaugh has gotten under his skin so badly.
That is the most hysterical part by a widest margin. It's not just him. He's getting under other people's skins, too. And I'm an Ohio State guy in a way myself, and I'm loving every second of it.
I do, too. It's great theater, and it's great for the Big Ten. And you know what? If it makes the SEC and Nick Saban look bad, then it's even better. So keep up the good work, Jim Harbaugh. We'll hit more of that tomorrow when we have a chance to talk about it. Good stuff today. Thank you, Jim. Thanks to our guests again, Damon Bruce and Rick Nolan. And thanks to you for listening and being a part of the show. We'll talk to you tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Drive Time's next. Stay right here.